Dobrý deň, vitajte opäť v podcaste Centra komunitného organizovania, ktorý sme nazvali Taktivist. A dnes tu so mnou sú špeciálni hostia a budeme sa rozprávať po anglicky, čo je prvýkrát. Je tu so mnou Adrian Evans. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Adrian je sociologička a komunitná organizátorka z organizácie United Vision for Idaho. A okrem nej teda je tu ešte druhý host, je to Janko Gálik. Ahoj, Janko.
Ahoj.
A Janko pracuje teraz...
Ja pracujem v IT a venujem sa rôznym iným činnostiam vrátane komunitného organizovania.
Áno, my sa s Jankom poznáme dlhšie. A Adrian je Janková mentorka v rámci programu Professional Fellows a budeme sa dneska rozprávať teda o komunitnom organizovaní, možno aj trošku o programe a samozrejme aj o polarizácii alebo radikalizácii. Okay, hello, welcome. So I'm switching back to English now so our lovely host can understand us. Janko can speak English as well very well. So I would like to maybe at the beginning ask you to introduce yourself a little bit and maybe something about the organization United Visions for Idaho, what you do, what's the goal, and why are you here maybe?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for hosting and having us today and really glad to be speaking to all of the listeners. I work for an organization. It is a multi-issue organization that works in the state of Idaho. And so we work on social, economic, environmental justice issues and thread those so that we can make greater context that all of these things have meaning for all of our lives and they shouldn't be focused on independently so that we can build social power and put that power back in the hands of people. I live in a state that has been undergoing attack and threat from white nationalist activity and slowly taking over, like many rural places in the country, our state houses and gaining positions of authority that are causing our democracy to be in real threat and on the verge of breaking. And so much of our work has focused on getting to the root. What is causing this division? What is causing people to become more alienated from one another and the institutions of democracy? And what is it going to take for us to come together as a people, as a country, and globally to fight back against these forces that would seek to diminish all of us for gaining seats of power and influence? So it's really a collective battle. For our collective interests.
It sounds very important and very interesting. I would like to maybe ask a little bit more about the background. Why are you now here? And maybe why Janko is here as well, so that we can introduce him as well.
Sure. Well, Jan, do you want to talk about the program?
Should I start?
Sure.
All right. Well, I've always been really interested in changing the world, right? So I think it's a natural thing that you want to change the world for the better. So I've been involved in many different activities, projects, community projects, or activism, and so on. And this fellowship, when I heard about it, I thought, yes, this is a wonderful opportunity to travel and talk to people who have been doing community organizing for a really long time. In Slovakia, I think community organizing is quite a new concept that we as a society still don't have all the tools, or we don't know how to use all the tools that democracy provides. And in the US, community organizing has a long tradition. So I wanted to learn from more experienced organizers. I wanted to look at what we have in common and also what are the differences between our countries. I do believe that in a world where we are free, we can travel, where the possibilities are really infinite and the world is globalized, we need to come together internationally. So, of course, in some issues like climate change, I think that's like easy to see that we cannot tackle this, you know, as Slovakia or as a different country or as the U.S. We really have to come together and work on this together. But not only climate change, which is obvious, but I also think that extremism, populism, radicalization, polarization, these are phenomena that are the same or almost the same all around the world. So you can see the same patterns, same kind of rhetoric, the same kind of problems that we're facing. So for me, it's very important to start thinking about these problems together on an international level. So I'm really happy I could be a part of this fellowship program. I went to Idaho for a month. I stayed and worked with Adrian and her team, and it was a wonderful experience.
Adrian, is it the, like Janko is telling us, is it the same with radicalization and extremism?
Yes and no. It's a complicated, it's complicated, right? So it's been very interesting to me. You know, first of all, a great honor to have Jan come and help us understand and unpack. I think one of the things about America is that we tend to see ourselves as the only country and very isolated, and it's a problem. And then coming here, there are some stark differences and yet similarities. I guess to point some of those out, I was surprised being in Hungary, how few people seem to be resisting or publicly acknowledging some of the struggle that's happening. In Slovakia, I think there's a tradition of protest. And so, and emerging, yes, right? But I've been thinking a lot about the presence of struggle and what is visible and the importance of that. And at the same time, I come from a deep tradition of strategic organizing. And so I see that there are some gaps in terms of what we can learn and how we can actually, you know, work together to come up with some strategies. Also for Slovakia, a young country, you know, not repeating some of the mistakes that the U.S. has made that we're paying for now.
What are those?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's always good to hear about mistakes. Sometimes maybe 2 years ago or 3 years ago, we were talking to Hungarian organizers and activists. And we were trying to get a grasp what they did wrong, because some situation in Hungary was already worse than in Slovakia. Mm-hmm. But it was very difficult to get the ideas what they did wrong. Most of the times it was like, yes, we didn't protest soon enough. Mm-hmm. We didn't start to react soon enough. Mm-hmm. But that's maybe not the only mistake that you can see.
I think what I would say universally amongst many countries is that the greatest failure we all share is that we've lost our ability to dream about a different world that we can create. And when powers that oppose people and separate people into labels or camps or designate people in terms of their worthiness, we begin on a very dangerous slope where we begin seeing each other differently. We begin thinking about what's possible and what's not possible, and seeing each other as enemy versus looking at the institutions that are trying to gain power and what they are, you know, often they have a long-term strategy, right? And so much of this plays out and it becomes invisible until we try to push back against the limits of what is now possible. And we find that we are now, too, relegated to other and that, it, you know, our lives have changed and we didn't see it coming. that I think is happening across the world. So I guess what I would say is protest is wonderful in the sense that it makes visible the struggle. Protest without strategy doesn't give people a way to organize and doesn't build long-term power, so that we are constantly building a base outside of political party that has the power and the ability to bend political parties to our will. And so I guess one of the things I would say is for everyone thinking about, you know, what is the world you want to live in? You know, what hurts? If you could have all of the things for you, yourself, and your community that would provide you the dignity and the basics to live and prosper and contribute, what would that be? And then work back from there. Where are we actually right now?
Janko, where are we actually right now?
Well, here in Slovakia or all over?
Yeah, in Slovakia.
Well, that's quite a specific situation we are.
It can help you with some more specific question. Because last 3 days we've been on a conference. We had in Banská Bystrica a conference called Human Forum, which is international conference about human rights. And there's a one topic that goes like all the time in the conference, and that's extremism and radicalization. And we've been talking about the local and regional elections on one debate. And there was, of course, two guys, very intelligent guys. And I had the feeling like most of the commentators and newspaper people are speaking that those elections ended well. For me personally, I don't agree. And maybe you would have some other perspective on that. Like, do we have a strategy to deal with extremism in Slovakia in terms of what Adrian said?
No, we don't. And the elections did not end up well. I mean, we talked about this a lot. I compared it also to the midterms in America, that just because the election could have been worse doesn't mean it's a success or that it's good. We lowered our standards so much that what we call a good turnout or success or the failure of extremists is actually, they're much stronger than they were before, right?
My thoughts exactly.
They got more seats, especially in like smaller cities and villages and so on. Even the big fish that wanted to become, well, I'm not sure how to say župan in English, but
leader of the region.
Leader of the region, right? They got 10%, which is a lot. That
in Banská Bystrica region, it was 30.
Yeah. Just one candidate, 30%.
No, I mean the extremist candidates.
Yeah, yeah. I mean
all
altogether,
of them.
It's horrible. Yeah, but I'm saying even losing on the regional level as leader of the region with 10% is a lot of votes. So this should be definitely a red flag. We have nothing to celebrate. We have to take this really, really seriously. And now when we look at the situation we are at right now, regional politics and national politics are different, but they influence each other a lot. So we've had oligarchic parties in power for a long time that had scandals, and there was corruption everywhere. And then there was this big, huge sense of hope, of change, that finally things will get better. And they didn't. Then we had crises like the pandemic, war in Ukraine, really horrible, troubling, tough times. And I think people are frustrated that our politicians on the national level didn't do a good job, and that this pushes the voters to look for alternatives, and this is something the extremists thrive on. At the same time, when you have extremists in regional politics, they get a new platform to spread their PR, and then it's easier for them to get into big politics. Here in Banská Bystrica, I've got experience with that. Like,
yes.
I don't know, 7-8 years ago, the fascist party of Marian Kotleba was an outsider.
Yeah, we were the entry gate to national
politics.
We have
to take the situation really, really seriously. And I don't think we are prepared. I don't think we have a good strategy. I know that there are people in institutions and in politics that understand and know that this is serious. But those are just a few individuals. And we have to really start analyzing this and creating a strategy on a systematic level, which I hope this can be a wake-up call for all of us.
Adrian, what's the strategy in the U.S. Tackling white supremacists and this extremism? Because I think you are in the midterm, yeah? You have election coming, and yeah, we all know that Donald Trump is trying to run for president again. Mm-hmm. So what's the strategy for you, maybe for Idaho?
Yeah, well, maybe I can back up just a second and say, how was it that a Donald Trump was possible, right? And it is also, we have to be very critical of our own movements and understand what it is that we have not done well. One is that we've never really come to terms with what we're up against. We've had successes and then thought, we'll celebrate and now we're done. And, you know, as I was saying to you earlier this week, unattended things fail, and democracy is no different. And so what happened in the U.S. is that there was a huge divestment of rural places across America, and nobody was organizing. Nobody was funded, and rights were systematically taken away, and it just became commonplace. You know, so that normalization of how we come to understand our world is really critical, because we need to pay attention. It doesn't always happen in the enormous moments that capture our attention. But so we need to be paying attention to what's happening at the local level, what's happening on a daily basis. And for that reason, it left open swaths of area of people who had no alternative. And so the extremists came in, far-right extremists came in, they started organizing, they started setting up community, building relationships, caring for communities that, you know, rightly were suffering. Yes, there are failures in our system, but rather than working together to create a better system and the infrastructure that we need, it just became blaming those institutions, which is the playbook, right? So what I would say, what is the strategy? We have to be talking to people, even if they have differing views, oppositional views. No one in our country, I think this is pretty universal, becomes aligned with authoritarian movements because, not no one, but most people, don't become aligned with these movements because of ideology. There is a deep hurt and pain and breaking that is happening in people. They crave solidarity. They crave companionship. They crave just interpersonal relation. And so when that's offered, those are the bonds that are hard to break. When we ask people, you know, tell me why you believe the things that you do, often it kind of falls apart upon more inquisitive, open-ended inquiry. What is harder is that these people are now my family, and I don't know how to break with them. So if we want to build a more inclusive movement, we need to be more inclusive. And that means meeting people where they are. An example would be, we have done this outreach. It's the largest set of data collected on white nationalist groups. We've reached out to 770,000 people across the U.S., across 5 states, to more deeply understand, what is it that is causing you to abandon democracy? And what we hear is that we don't trust the systems. And to, you know, we also hear we don't trust democracy because we haven't seen it work for us. Now, that's not entirely the case. I think maybe you don't recognize how it's been working for you until you don't have it anymore. But that's the thinking, right? And so if we ask someone, why is our country more divided than it's ever been, what do you think is causing this? Someone might name a racial group, an ethnic group. And then the question would be, that's interesting. Can you tell me more about how did you first form your ideas around race? Where were you living? What did life look like? Were there people of color or different ethnicities living in your community? Was there an experience that you had? And when we start probing in that way, just deep inquiry, many people say, I don't know, it's just always been that way. And that opens up possibility for us to entertain together the notion that we could think differently and do differently. But I would say that this binary of good versus bad, where we relegate people to a label or a position and treat them as though they are fixed in that and they can never move. A probe would be to every listener, when is the last time you changed your mind about something really important? Was it because somebody told you to? Or was it because you had an experience or a moment that allowed you to see something from a different perspective? Hopefully, we are all growing and changing and learning. But we have to afford each other the grace and the possibility to learn, to grow, to change, and to become accountable to one another. I was just talking to a woman the other day, and the analogy she gave was like a parent. When you're raising a child, you hold that child, and you know that child will make mistakes. You want that child to make mistakes because that's how they learn. But when they make mistakes, you don't cast them out. You continue to hold them. And it's a process. And I think until we can learn how to treat each other that way and also confront our own biases, we all have them, right? We live within the structures and institutions that we were raised. But again, we should all ask ourselves, who is deserving and who is not and why not, right?
Very difficult. I mean, when you were talking about the biases, I can see it myself in me that I do have a bias against people who are not trusting the system at the moment. Mm-hmm. Maybe not the trusting, but those who are actively fighting at the moment mm-hmm. against the system. So maybe my question would be, if you can imagine us like a small village in Idaho where no one was ever working as an organizer or, you know, it's like God forbidden village. Yeah. What would be the steps to start mm-hmm. As, you know, something happened in that village and now we'll try to shift the narrative and maybe shift the atmosphere in that village so that they don't become radicalized?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you from experience what we've done. And so first I would say, I am not suggesting that it is either our work or that we have the ability to de-radicalize those most radicalized.
Of course not.
Right. But I do think that there are a lot of people who are susceptible. If it's the only thing you ever hear and there is no alternative, we have to be the ones offering that alternative. And it can't be just a campaign. It can't be just an election. It's got to be building relationship for a future that we may not even see, right? So thinking of seven generations ahead of us and seven generations behind us, where do we stand in this moment and what are we cultivating together? Our experience is that when you meet people and say, hi, how are you? I live here, you live here. What's hurting? What is your struggle? Do we have common things? We don't have to share every similarity, right? But there are always things that can unite us. Maybe it's healthcare. Maybe it's housing, right? But what we do is when we go out and we talk to people, we always go with a predetermined date. So we will have a gathering and we'll ask people to bring a favorite food, to share so that we can actually start meeting each other. So I might come to your door and say, hi, my name's Adrian. I'm here. I'm out here talking to people because I am so worried about where we are. And I really, I just want to know, what do you think? Right? Most people will say, I think I said, like, nobody's ever asked me before. And to this point, I would say it's about you talking 80% of the time and me talking 20% of the time to really deeply listen. And when we meet on those issues, to say, could I invite you to come be my guest? Sounds like you have a lot in common with the community that you live in and people who are suffering in the same way. And it's that kind of building and then coming together to imagine what would a world look like that we could co-create together? And then how will we work together to do that for the long term? Not an election. One of the big failures of America is that we have treated everything as expedient, right? 2 years midterms, 4 years presidency. We've got a policy that we've got to pass immediately. So we tend to only talk to people when we need something from them. And that's not how you build relationships. It's not how you build a people's movement. It's about meeting people all the time and building that kind of sense of solidarity. I believe that if we can't do that, the U.S. may not have a democracy, but also, you know, understanding the global impact, it makes a huge difference across the world if we can't hold what we've built.
I understand. I had in mind a village close by because, yes, we talked about it yesterday as well. And it seems like it brought up a lot of stir. And it's the village of Sliač. And it was the elections, but Sliač has a referendum about the American
military base,
because Sliač is a small city, but it has an airport and it's very close by. And the airport is the military one. And so there was a lot of fear when the war started in Ukraine, a lot of fear about that Sliač will become a target because of the military base, and it will become even a higher target when NATO armies would be placed there, or even a U.S. base will be placed there. The truth was, or the fact was, that it will never be a U.S. base there. It's a NATO military base. But the referendum was that people, if the people would agree that there will be a U.S. military base, which was based on hoax or lies that was spread by extremists. Mm-hmm. So maybe I would ask both of you, and even Janko, since you are now being mentored by Adrian, can we put some strategy towards maybe Sliač, but maybe there are some more villages and cities that are in similar positions, being misled by extremists, misled by Kotleba Party or Republika Party. Can we prepare some strategies, some steps? What can we do now?
Well, I wish I had the recipe or the solution, because I think this is a widespread problem that we've been thinking about a lot, and it's really hard to combat hoaxes and conspiracy theories. Once a conspiracy theory gets out and people read it, they don't follow up and read the explanation or something that debunks the conspiracy theory. The real tragedy here is that today not only extremists are spreading propaganda and misinformation, but also mainstream, or what used to be mainstream, politicians. So these mainstream politicians are using the same language, the same rhetoric as extremists, because they see that as an opportunity to find new voters, to spread their voter base, right? Which is a huge problem. I don't think that the extremists would be capable of doing or influencing Sliač on their own. I think our politicians from the previous government helped them quite a lot, even though they were the ones actually negotiating these things. So as far as strategy goes, sure, debunking conspiracies, that's an important thing to do. We should continue with that. But also, like, pre-bunking, that kind of expecting what could happen and be prepared with media content, social media content, and so on. So in a way, this information war, it's also a race. Who comes first, he gets the most attention. I know that some people have already started doing that, thinking about what might happen and preparing for it. So I think that's one part of it. I mean, politicians can do quite a lot, but unfortunately we are not politicians, so we can just demand or show them that we would like them to be different in this sense. And then also, we've talked about this, or Adrian talked about this, people from smaller cities, villages, they feel forgotten. Nobody's ever been there. Nobody.
Except of Kotleba.
Except of Kotleba, yeah. So nobody visits, nobody talks to them, nobody listens. Listening is like most important thing. And if you come once in 4 years before the election and give out some free pens, that doesn't do it. People are not that stupid.
No, I think it was what Adrian said. If you come there and ask for something, people are probably not willing to listen. Mm-hmm. But if you come there and offer or just listen, that can be a way.
That's what we can do. And all of us, even as not only as politicians, but as organizers, as organizations, a lot of the times nonprofits or other organizations, they truly want to help, and they do have a good intentions, but we need people from these areas to participate in the process in order for them to gain some trust, and then we have an opportunity to really talk. Like, if we keep on coming up with solutions in cities and then bringing these solutions to the countryside or to smaller areas, that just doesn't work. We know it doesn't, and we should change that. So we should listen and give a chance for other people to participate.
Yeah, I mean, in no way can we diminish the role of media and the power, and the lack of independent media. So I'd say first, I would absolutely encourage people to question, why do I believe what I'm reading, and what could be the underlying motivation for what I'm reading, right? But perhaps it's easier to think about this in a U.S. context for our listeners today. So think about why the far right is targeting the areas that they're targeting. In the U.S., it is typically poorer communities, rural communities, communities that don't have a lot of power and have been suffering. And then, the goal then is to direct the solution and the cause of that, and to a failing system, and the solution for that is, excuse me, or the reason for that is the other. Maybe it's immigrants, maybe it's a person of color, maybe it's women, maybe it's LGBTQ, right? In those communities, though, it tends to be that the right will organize all of those people until they have enough people. And then they systematically eliminate those groups that they have never supported. So I think most people don't want to feel like they are the pawns of a more elaborate scheme or want to be manipulated. Of all the rural people I know, these are hardworking, decent people. And they don't want to be used by powers that are ultimately, any power outside of themselves, but also powers that are not forthcoming or honest about how they see you, your family, and your community in their broader struggle. And I guarantee this, that poor white people will not be the ones who succeed under an authoritarian regime. It has never been the case. We are all just a pawn. We are a chip, a chess piece, right? And they're very good about denying that this is racist, sexist, homophobic, all of those things until it happens. You know, I think, you know, we look at the Holocaust, right? They came for this group and I did nothing. Then they came for this group and I did nothing. Then they came for this group and I did nothing. And then they came for me. And there was no one left. To give another analogy would be like bullying in school, right? I often tell students that if you have somebody who's bullying and being racist or horrible or misogynistic or threatening, for that one person that steps up and says, stop, enough, you will not do that, what is required then of everyone else in that space is to go and support the person that interrupted that action. And with that, you create more people. You change the norms. You change the culture. You create the conditions so that that bully becomes the outcast as you continue to form solidarity with one another. It's very simple, really.
Simple, but not easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always think that for us as activists, it's sometimes really difficult to step down. Sometimes we are on a higher ground, looking below on many people who are not agreeing with us, and it's really difficult difficult step to do, to step down and start to build relationships with people who disagree. But maybe I have one more question for you, and that's like really practical, is that you spoke about that people would understand that they are pawns. Sometimes I feel it's not easy to explain to them and for them to see that they are the pawns. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are so deep in those schemes and in those lies and in those manipulations, mm-hmm. that it's really difficult. They could have access to independent media. They could have access to different sources and stuff like that. But they don't want to see that. Maybe they don't have the skills to see that. And they for sure don't ask those questions. Where's the source? What's the source of the information? Why the information is being spread out? So do we have any sort of like tools or steps what we can help them, but not in a way like being like at the top and telling them you have to do this, yep. do this, and you cannot believe this, but maybe to get them to understand what the problem is.
Yeah, I guess if anyone takes anything from our time together today, I guess I would say it's really important to understand none of us will convince another human being to change their hearts and their minds. It is only through deep conversation and asking that someone starts to say reveal the contradictions of their own thinking that causes them to shift, right? So just that inquisitive inquiry, that's interesting. Can you tell me how has your life improved under the conditions that you're living in? And how do you see your life improving if this person comes to power? How, you know, just questioning, how, why? And then, you know, having the courage to not respond in anger. People do not respond to, I'm right, you're wrong. And I would say we have a lot to learn. In those conversations that I've been having, I've learned a lot about, wow, there are some similarities here. It's like, you know, we might actually have the same analysis about a few things. We just have different ideas about the solution. And so it is long work. It's long arc work to try and create those conditions. But if we're not talking to people, the only one left talking to them in that way is the far right. And so it is time for all of us to lay down that mantle of right makes might, because it just isn't the case.
Indeed. Thank you very much. Janko, any final thoughts in this podcast?
Well, I know a lot of people are frustrated, unhappy, maybe pessimistic. There's been a lot going on. It's been a tough few years. But I believe that things will get better and that we need to be patient and don't lose our values and our moral compass. So I wish the best of luck to everyone who's feeling the same way that I am.
Thank you, both of you, for coming here with me today. Thank you for really important views, and hope we'll see each other and hear each other again.
Thank you so much. I look forward to all of the days of practicing democracy with you and for all of us.
Adrian Evans and Janko Gálik. Moje meno je Martina Strmeňová, môžem už aj po slovensky, a počúvali ste podcast Centra komunitného organizovania. Do počutia.